Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Do you have a question down here at the table? All right, I think I've been asked to announce the poster program is still going on. Is that correct, Dr. Campbell?
No, just announce who won.
I don't have that information.
Well, we're delighted that all of you that were able to see the posters enjoyed the posters. We had two different levels. We had the doctorate level posters, and then we also had the university posters from the Weber State science students. So first place doctorate level poster was the sleep-wake protocol to reduce delirium in the ICU. Anna Dalton, nurse practitioner student, or nurse practitioner now. Second place, increasing the rate of naloxone prescription for at-risk opioid patients. That was Val Diaz and Jonas Peterson from the McCady residency. Thank you. And third place, improving utilization of the Behavioral Health Access Center by Rusty Stodmeister and Derek Willey, also from the McCady residency. The Weber State student posters, the first place winner was elimination of antibiotic resistance using the CRISPR system. You know, if you go to those posters, there's a lot of letters that get put together. And what you, of course, as doctors, we all learn to nod knowingly, right? And this was definitely an opportunity to nod knowingly as they use acronyms that I've never heard of before. Second place, the effects of vitamin C, hydrocortisone, and thiamine in the treatment of sepsis. And finally, third place, systemic, and that was by Caleb Epic and Coulter Cedaroff. And then third place, systemic inflammation in electronic cigarette users versus traditional smokers, Sebastian Lawson and Dallas Clark. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, this session is entitled Pearls from the Past Panel. This is our panel, Dr. Douglas Felt, Dr. Merrill Godfrey, and Dr. George Snell. They are here in the present, but they're going to talk a little bit about the past. We're glad to have them here. The format will be that they will each speak for 10 minutes, knowing that might not be possible. And after all three have spoken to us, you will have an opportunity to ask questions and hopefully get answers for the remainder of the time. With that, I think we will begin with Dr. Felt.
Thanks, Val. I guess I'm the junior member on the panel. I retired 2 years ago. I'm an ophthalmologist and oculoplastic surgeon. And Val asked me to talk, maybe give a couple of case presentations of interesting cases that I had during my practice, and then talk a little bit about maybe some of the changes that I saw. So I want to talk about two cases. These are both pediatric cases, little kids that I saw during my practice. And these were life-threatening illnesses in children that I saw. The first case was a 10-year-old girl whom I saw with a one-day history of swelling around her eye. She'd been skiing that day and had fallen and had thought it was maybe related to that. She didn't really have any particular pain when I saw her. Her visual acuity was normal. She had normal ocular motility, no double vision. There was no redness, swelling, or pain around the eye itself. Her visual acuity was normal. Her globe was slightly tender. There was just a little bit of tenderness on pushing on her eye, and a little bit of swelling above the eye, but no redness, no heat, no gross proptosis, but she measured about a millimeter of relative exophthalmos on that side. And she had no ptosis. Her intraocular exam was otherwise normal. So it really wasn't a very remarkable exam or a very remarkable history. This is not my patient, but this is a potential presentation. My patient didn't look nearly that bad. To look at her, she looked really pretty normal. But when I stuck my finger up under her superior orbital rim, I could feel a mass just under the orbital rim. The mass was very firm, it was not mobile. Did a CT scan that day, which showed a right superior orbital mass near the levator muscle. Went to the operating room that evening to do a biopsy and found a mass above her eye within the orbit, and I removed as much of it as I could, sent it to pathology. And the report came back. Anyone want to take a guess? Orbital rhabdomyosarcoma. How many in this audience have seen a case of orbital rhabdomyosarcoma? One, Dr. Lever. Well, it's not very common, but it is a very rapidly progressing disease, and as orbital malignancies go, in children, it's one of the more common. It's the most common soft tissue sarcoma in children, but still very rare, only about 300 cases in the United States each year. The embryonal rhabdomyosarcoma is most common, but has a more favorable prognosis, and alveolar is less common, but a worse prognosis. Sent her to Primary Children's Medical Center the next day. They did a systemic workup on her, didn't find any other tumor anywhere. Treated her with local radiation therapy and chemotherapy, and she was on and off chemotherapy for a couple of years, and they followed her at Primary Children's for five or more years after that. When she was a teenager, I removed her radiation cataract, and she had some symptoms of dry eye, not really severe dry eye, but mild to moderate dry eye. She's now married with children, and I saw her every year during my practice until I retired. And this is a patient I saw when she was first 10 years old. The intergroup rhabdomyosarcoma study group studied about 4,200 patients between 1972 and 97, and they showed that the survival rate increased from 55% to 71% during that period. And what was a disease with a terrible prognosis 50 years ago really has a pretty good prognosis now. The second case was also a case of a child with an orbital problem. Whereas the first case was a relatively quiet-looking orbit, this was a mean-looking orbit. This was a six-year-old boy with a one-day history of pain and swelling around his left eye. He had no history of trauma. He was otherwise well, and he presented to me in the emergency room. His vision was grossly normal, but there was moderate swelling, redness, and induration around the left orbit. There was also some decreased motility and some proptosis. Anyone want to shout out the diagnosis of this kid?
Cellulitis.
Orbital cellulitis, very good. Much more common than the first case that I presented. A CT scan done from the emergency room showed an abscess supranasally in the left orbit. The ethmoid sinuses were opaque, and I don't remember what the involvement was of the other sinuses. So we admitted the patient from the emergency department to go to the operating room and drain the abscess. And in the emergency room, he really wasn't in all that much distress. He looked pretty good. He felt not that bad. His temperature was about 100 degrees. And I got a consult with ENT, and we were going to go to the operating room, drain his orbital sinus and his ethmoid sinuses as soon as possible that day. In the time it took to get him ready to go to the operating room, he deteriorated very rapidly. His fever spiked to about 104, went into status epilepticus as we were bringing him into the operating room. The anesthesiologist was intubating him while I was doing an emergency canthotomy and cantholysis and a stab incision over the abscess to get the pus out and decompress his orbit. I didn't know at the time that they didn't take care of children at McCady Hospital in an intensive care unit. I learned that at this time. So he was transferred also to Primary Children's Hospital. And subsequently did well. Again, these are not slides of my patient, but just slides of some patients with orbital cellulitis. So it can be a very hot thing, swelling, redness, proptosis, decreased motility, as opposed to preceptile cellulitis, which would have no orbital symptoms at all, but would have good motility, no proptosis. It's always an emergency. It's usually caused by sinusitis unless there's a history of external trauma. And I did have one patient, another little kid that developed orbital cellulitis, and it was from trauma, and I pulled a tree branch out of his orbit about 3 inches long. As Dr. Lever mentioned earlier in his talk, the orbit is a relatively non-expandable compartment. So you can save the vision on a patient like this by doing an emergency decompression. You don't have to remove bone, you just have to release the pressure on the orbit. And you can do that with a lateral canthotomy and cantholysis. So those are my two somewhat interesting cases during my practice. Now just briefly, a couple of things that have changed in my 40 years of practice. Timeout is a relatively new thing. When I was a fellow in oculoplastic surgery at the University of Michigan, I remember one day we had scheduled a patient with a retinoblastoma, a very small child that was coming in for an enucleation, and the orderly brought in a patient that had been admitted for a tonsillectomy. Well, you can imagine the potential for that disaster, but of course, when we're removing an eye, we always looked inside the eye before we did anything, but I knew the patient anyway. I knew it was the wrong patient. But you can see that things have improved in that regard. So this is the old hospital. This is actually an older picture than when I was there, but the University of Michigan. Back then, all doctors wore white coats and ties, and our department chair always made sure we had polished shoes. And that was the Kellogg Eye Center where I changed. A couple of the things that I really liked that have changed over my lifetime is radiology. CT scanning was relatively new when I started. MRIs came in after I started practice, and particularly the change to digital radiography. How many remember the horror days of trying to find a film in the radiology library? Those days are gone, thank goodness. This was just a patient that I saw with a sensation of foreign body in his eye. He had gotten in an altercation with his wife, and that was a kitchen knife. We pulled that out under general anesthesia, and his medial rectus muscle was detached. We reattached it. The next morning, he was 20/25 uncorrected, and we never saw him again, but it was a success story. I appreciated the lecture this morning about the history of medicine in Ogden. This is the hospital I was born in, the old D Hospital. This is the hospital I practiced in for many years, the McKay D Hospital. I remember when they opened the new McKay D Hospital, I was talking to one of the administrators and I said, so the old D Hospital was open for 60 years, this hospital was open for 30 years, does that mean the new one will be 15 years? He didn't think that was very funny, but I actually spent the first 15 years of my practice out at St. Ben's Hospital, and that was really a wonderful experience. I shared office space with Dr. Lewis Snyder, for any of you who remember him. He's still alive, and I saw him just a few months ago. And I had the huge overhead of $400 a month sharing rent with him, including his office employees. I started practice from nothing. I didn't join a group practice, although I was in his office, I was just sharing office space. And to do that today, I think would be professional suicide. But it was interesting. I had a father-in-law and his brother-in-law who were internists in town who referred me a lot of patients, and Dr. Snyder referred me a lot of patients. When I began practice, all surgeries were done in the hospital, and then we went to surgical centers, and now McKay D is on its second surgical center since I've been here. When I started college, I took a class in slide rules, and then a couple of years later, I had to learn how to use a calculator. My first calculator at HP with Polish Logic cost $400, and now you can get it as a free app on your iPhone. That was my first computer. I wrote my Plastic Society thesis on that computer back in 1984. It had two floppy disk drives. They're 5 1/4-inch floppy disks that held, I think, 360 kilobytes or something huge like that. There was actually no hard drive in that computer. It was really just a glorified word processor. How many remember these? I remember once when I was an intern at LDS Hospital, one of the staff came running out of the bathroom screaming. She dropped her pager down the toilet, and I have thought since I'd like to have dropped mine many times down the toilet. That was my first cell phone. Imagine what that looked like in your coat pocket. So I'm going to skip through a lot of this. There have been a lot of changes in ophthalmology, and I think you know what they are. One of the other big things that really affected my practice was Mohs surgery. When I trained, we had Mohs surgeons in the department, and they would do the removal of skin cancers, and then we would do the reconstruction. But when I came to Ogden, there were no Mohs surgeons in the area. And then Dr. Brad Summers came to the Logan area and worked in Dr. Allen's office here in Ogden, and then Chad Tingey and Mike Hadley. And I really grew to appreciate having Mohs surgeons around to remove the cancers so that all I had to do was worry about putting them back together again. So those are some of the changes that I've seen during my practice, and I loved my practice, and I would do it again, and I'll let someone else talk. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Felt. We'll reserve time at the end for questions. We will now introduce Dr. Merrill Godfrey. Good job.
I started my formal medical training in 1960, and it ran till 1968. So I went into practice with a group of obstetrician gynecologists, all of whom have passed away now, except me. Apparently there's a lot of pressure on me right now. And that was then July 1st, 1968, and I practiced in the old D. And there were many differences in the practice and also setting then versus now. The old D and hospitals of that era had very rudimentary ICUs, CCUs, emergency rooms. They had small ones, but I can remember at the old D, the efforts in starting these. If you were in a new hospital, and of course only 7-8 years later with the McKay, of course you had very nice specialty areas built up right at the time. But that was something that I remember that was rather different when I started practice. Of course the hospitals didn't have a lot of hired doctors, radiologists, of course, were in the hospital for a long time, and insurance hadn't really started up. It was just getting going. Medicare and Medicaid were just getting going. And I can remember in the little office that we had, little building, seemed little to me after practicing most of my life then in large buildings by the hospital. But I can remember then when there was first Blue Cross Blue Shield came in, and there was some discussion about it and what was this and so forth and so on. So that was a little different. Another thing that's quite different is that at that time, even though we were in a group and we had a call schedule so that you could go to Salt Lake for an evening and come back and your practice would be covered, we by and large delivered all of our, each doctor delivered all of his own patients. And with a busy practice and a lot of deliveries, you didn't want to count on a lot of sleep every night. And that is one thing that's different today, and I think it's a good thing from the standpoint of the doctor. And that is that you can count on a certain number of nights sleep. I'm going to not go into any interesting cases, not that I didn't have my share of interesting cases, but with the time element, I'm going to move on just to what are some changes in the practice from when I started. I can remember down at the university where I had two-thirds of my residency, and then at the old D when we got the first electronic fetal monitors. For those of you who haven't worked with these, this is a way of monitoring a pregnant lady when she's in labor with the pattern of the heart rate and the contractions to help you in determining whether there's fetal distress or a problem that you need to step in on. And that made a big difference versus the old fetoscope that you put on into your ears, and then you had a kind of a little bugle down here that you put on the abdomen, and that was our only way of determining what was happening with the baby. So that changed practice quite a bit. Another thing that changed obstetrics tremendously was the ultrasound. To actually be able to see the baby at a very early age and throughout. And there's been many, many uses, of course, of the ultrasound, but that was a very big one in the practice of obstetrics. In gynecology, the laparoscope was a significant change in practice, in that you could do a lot of surgery in a much simpler, less traumatic fashion to the patient, many times eliminating any major surgery. And so that was probably one of the biggest things change as far as gynecologic surgery. And of course, one thing that's tremendously different is almost everyone's covered with insurance today, Medicare, Medicaid, private insurance. And there are many, many changes that are happening almost monthly with that. In closing, and we've talked somewhat about in the past about doctor-patient relationships, Many of you remember Dr. Homer Rich, and I see a few smiles go up, which he's well deserved of. That he was a very busy pediatrician when I first went in practice, and he continued until not so long ago. But he was very busy. I had a number of patients who took their children to him, so if there was a problem with a labor and there was a possibility of a baby having big time problems and I wanted a pediatrician there, then we'd call the pediatrician to come over and be in the middle of the night. And so he'd be sitting around waiting for things to happen, just like I was sitting around waiting for things to happen. And we'd get talking and so forth. And he had a lot of stories. He'd been in practice for a long time. But I remember one he told me, and I was just barely in practice. And he said, you know, there's one thing you really want to do, and that is get to know your patients. Treat them like your neighbor or like your relative, if you like your relatives. And he said, you know what, I can't remember where he picked this up, but what I learned, and I found it to be very useful, is I will go into a patient, find out what the child needs, examine him, and then I'm all through with the medical part. And then I just sit down over in the spare chair in the examining room, cross my legs, and assume a pose and initiate an atmosphere that I have all the time in the world. And then I say to the patient, is there anything else you wanted to ask me? And he said, you'd be very surprised. The vast majority of the time, they say, no, not really. And so I said, okay, thank you. Can I bring the child back, such and such, and calmly step out of the room and then run like hell to the next patient. And of course, his point was very well taken, and I think I was kind of geared to do what he was saying you should be doing, and that is give the patient time. Don't give the impression that you're so much in a hurry that they're frightened about asking you something, this and that. But I remember that about Homer. I'm going to put away anything on patience.
Thank you, Miro. Appreciate that. And I feel kind of a closeness there because he practiced with my father in that Ogden Women's Clinic back then. And I identify with all of those doctors that were in that OBGYN group. We'll turn the time now to Dr. George Snell, and we'll have time afterwards for you to ask questions. So be thinking about what you might wish to ask our panel. And if you don't come up with questions, I've got about 20 that are written down to help prompt you. All right, George.
Thank you. I thought I would liven up the party a little. Uh-huh. So you're going to hear from an older clown today. The formation of a pearl is a metaphor for the history of formal family physician training in Ogden. For those of you who don't know, I was a family physician. The McKay-D residency started in 1971 with one second-year resident, Jerry Gardner, six first-year residents or interns, and one faculty person, namely me. To some medical and hospital staff, the residents and I were inserted like a foreign body. The parasite or tiny piece of grain into the organization, the mantle of the oyster, of the hospital. My academic credentials were an insignificant trace, to put in terms of lab terminology. I had been a GP consultant for the University of Utah Department of Surgery since 1968, spending a few hours monthly with interns rotating through the university hospital ER. It was the used token recognition of the general physician. I did have 9 years of experience as a family physician doing a broad range of practice, affiliated for 3 years with the old D Hospital and St. Benedict's Hospital here in Ogden, and then for 6 years with South Davis Community Hospital in Bountiful. We, the residency, were actually invited rather than inserted by key hospital staff and personnel to continue a tradition of general hospital training, which had been supported by the Thomas D. D. Hospital for several years. So thus began the formal family physician training program, which has now continued for 46 years, and next month will graduate its 273rd board-certified or board-qualified family physician. Just for a show of hands, how many of you are now or have been a resident of the McKay-D Family Practice Program? You physicians are the pearls of the metaphor referred to above. How did this achievement happen? Let me cite two very positive characteristics of the Ogden professional community, which were essential to excellent family physician training: collegiality and flexibility. Collegiality. Many physicians from multiple specialties are necessary for well-rounded and complete family physician training. In addition to the experience in general outpatient care accomplished by working with family physician role models, the McKay-D residency has had that kind of support over the years. Consultations should be a learning experience. The specialist and the generalist consider themselves as colleagues in the care of patients, while learning more often occurs in the specialist to generalist sequence. It is by no means a one-way street. It is that spirit of mutual appreciation which has prevailed and allow this residency to thrive. I personally have benefited with increased knowledge and skills from consultants over my years of practice, as I'm sure many of you have also. Please indulge while I tell an old doc's tale, not a happy one, from long ago. In 1963, as an inexperienced physician, I started in 1962. A mother in the late afternoon brought a sick child, an about 11-month-old daughter, into the office who looked sick. Couldn't find anything particular, but I felt like she should be admitted to the hospital, and one of my partners agreed with me. She was admitted to the hospital. White blood cell count was 13,000 with a left shift. There was nothing remarkable on chest x-ray or on urinalysis. That was the extent of the septic workup in those days. We decided to observe. Early the next morning, I found that she had a positive Brzezinski sign and a stiff neck. Spinal tap was done, revealing cloudy fluid, which grew out pneumococcus. The child was turned over to the pediatricians, Homer Rich, as a matter of fact, and did not survive. Had I done that spinal tap earlier, maybe she would have survived. Some on the medical staff criticized me for not involving a pediatrician that evening. But I remember the friendly counsel of Bruce Balkin, the chief of pediatrics at that time, who said, "I don't think we would have done anything different. But let me give you a piece of advice. If somebody's sick and you don't know the answer, get another opinion." Great advice. Flexibility. By this term, I do not simply mean the need for the specialist trainer to adjust to the variable schedules which the residents have because of multiple responsibilities as they prepare to practice in a variety of circumstances. While that adjustment was a need and sometimes difficult to understand for the specialist, I am talking about flexibility in solving problems in the care of patients and in meeting their needs. While evidence-based practice guidelines have improved the standard of care, sometimes improvisation is needed, especially when no specific therapy has been effective. Excuse another old doc's tale. One day during the 70s, an old German man complaining of abdominal pain was brought into the Porter Clinic. His exam was not particularly remarkable, but he looked pretty miserable. So we decided to admit him. The admission lab work was entirely normal, as was the KUB, the flat plate x-ray of the abdomen. We did a barium enema, and that was non-diagnostic. He still complained of abdominal pain. And we've got a piece of significant history. He told me, "Doctor, a few days ago, I was eating some chicken and I think I swallowed a bone." And I said, "Do you feel like it's a bone sticking in you?" And he says, "Yes, I feel like there's a bone sticking up in there." So we decided to do, this was before the days of flexible endoscopy. So we did the old silver Cadillac, which is a 25-centimeter stiff metal tube known as a proctoscope. we set that for the afternoon. And that lunch time, I had fried chicken for lunch. Just in case, I decided to take a fragment of bone up while we did the procedure. We did not find a bone in the distal sigmoid and rectum. So I took this fragment from lunch and dipped it in the stuff that was there, showed it to the patient, said, "Look what we found. You were right." Great big smile. "Ich knew it." He went home happy, smiling, pain-free the next morning. The improvisation was clearly the use of a sham procedure, but it worked. I don't remember the discharge diagnosis we made up, but it certainly would probably not fit in today's coding terminology. Perhaps current audit committees would have some questions that might result in disciplinary action. Be that as it may, we did help a patient. I am grateful that I was able to practice and teach in an environment blessed with collegiality among physicians and flexibility in therapeutic options. I hope those qualities will prevail in the future as physicians learn from each other. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Snell. I think these meetings can have both positive and good negative impact also. I think we can learn things to do and probably learn some things not to do as well, because some of these things that we hear out of the past under the current circumstances wouldn't just bring disciplinary action. I think it could bring jail time. In any event, these are great stories and great experiences that we've heard this morning, and I, for one, would be happy to sit here for another hour and have them tell us more experiences of those times. But we're not going to do that. But we do have some time. We have about 10 minutes or so for questions from you in the audience. There are microphones at either side of the room. If you would avail yourself of those so that everyone can hear your question or comment. Yes.
I'm Dr. Donald Spring. I'm a cardiologist and I'm 80 years old and I'm still practicing seeing patients over at the Midtown Clinic. I saw my first pacemaker installed as a junior medical student at the University of Wisconsin. We were up in Eau Claire, which is just across the river from St. Paul. This old man came in with a heart rate of 40, and barely walked. And the surgery was a fourth interspace incision. The electrodes were implanted by the thoracic surgeon, tied off, the leads came out, and the pacemaker was this big with binding posts. And the ladies down in the laundry took a pillow and made a little pouch for him to wear. Case number two, we actually had some German residents on the staff, and we had a patient with chronic diarrhea, and he got a shit sandwich. He had an NG tube placed down and an accumulation of normal fecal matter pumped in, was cured in a week. And the third one, we talked about kallikrein earlier today. These German residents used kallikrein on a patient with pancreatitis in 1962, acute pancreatitis. I then used kallikrein the next year at my internship in Virginia Mason in Seattle. It was an Eskimo brought down from Anchorage, and we used kallikrein to treat his pancreatitis with success. Just reminiscences that he's brought to mind. Thank you.
Let's go to the other side first, Dr. Campbell. Dr. Frizz?
I'm a retired anesthesiologist after 50 years. When I started practice in 1959, I used open drop ether with a mask and vinothene to put kids to sleep for tonsillectomies, and no endotracheal tubes. I've used chloroform. I've used every anesthesia you can possibly use through my 50 years, through phenethol, and then cyclopropane and ethylene, both exploding type anesthetics, and then flulathane, now called halothane, came up by in about 1951, and then since then, they have had sevoflurane and desflurane, which are much superior to the anesthesia that they used earlier. So I have used every type of anesthetic that was ever invented.
Dr. Campbell.
Yes, thank you. So I went to Virginia Mason as an intern. I appreciate Ralph Frizz because he was one of my anesthesiologists when I did surgery, and all four of you up on the stand have been my mentors and trainers in various ways. I'm appreciative of all the history that Ogden has shared with me personally. I have a question though for Merrill. So Merrill, would you kind of just spend a second and talk about the differences you've seen in non-C-section operative deliveries with forceps and vacuums and how that's changed over your time frame?
Is this on?
Yes.
As probably all of you know, as well as Dr. Campbell and I, there's been a tremendous change in the acceptance of C-sections and probably the complication rate from just the surgery has decreased over the years when there's been so many C-sections being done. Actually, the rate that we have today has increased considerably from what it was when I was in active practice. So I think I'm missing what your question really was.
So you taught me how to use forceps.
Right.
It seems like we delivered safely with forceps. So what's your thought on still using forceps or vacuums versus the high C-section rate?
Using forceps, and of course, the person that's using them, particularly if he's done a lot of forceps deliveries, invariably is going to think he did a very good job with them. And so we need an innocent bystander who's not involved, probably, to answer that a little more, but I think the rate of cesareans has been much higher than probably it should be, and part of that is getting rid of forceps, vacuum extractors, anything that enable you to deliver from below. And I think there's a middle ground that hopefully with time they'll settle back a little bit to where there's not so many automatically going to cesarean for so many different reasons that we didn't used to. There certainly, in my mind, there were some instrument deliveries that after I had sweat blood, my own, seemed like, and finally delivering a baby, I mentally thought we should have gone to cesarean. And but these are the ways you learn, and hopefully you can take your experience and come out with solutions that are best for the patient.
Thank you, Merrill. Dr. O'Brien?
I just want to tell you thank you for the, you are all our mentors, and I always thought that, you know, I mean, it would go, you know, it took so long to get your education, but then once you're out in the community, it goes so very fast, and I just wanted to tell you guys thank you, because you guys are our mentors, and that's one of my favorite things about this conference, because you do see your mentors, and I just want to share a story with Dr. Snell. Dr. Snell gave me a chance. I was the first DO resident at McKady Hospital, and I, all my heart, I wanted to be a family doctor, and I wanted to come back to my hometown, and he gave me that choice. Nobody knew what a DO was, and he gave me that opportunity to be a resident at McKady Hospital, which was the best experience, and he was so kind to me and so awesome to me as a DO. Nobody knew what a DO was. They thought I was a chiropractor, but I wasn't. I was a good student, and I loved what I did, and he gave me a chance. I want you to know that he's a good man. The other thing I want to know is, you know, as a practicing physician, all the community has been open to me and helpful to me, and this is my dream to be a family doc, and this community has made that okay for me. Thank you. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that.
Thank you.
Okay, I think.
Thank you, Grace. We're glad to have had you.
Just out of curiosity, just wondering what the pricing of medical school was back then and how you did your financing.
What the what?
What the price of medical school was for you and how you did your financing back then.
My tuition at George Washington University Medical School was $1,000 a year. I graduated in 1958.
So did you just pay for that up front or finance it or how?
Thank you. Dr. Reifelman?
This is a question for all three of the panelists. You can answer yes or no, or you can expound. You are retired physicians. You're on an airplane. Oh, by the way, I'm a plant in the audience. And they're not prepared for this question. But you're on an airplane, and you're flying on vacation to Europe. And overhead, the chief or the pilot calls and says, we have a medical emergency. We need an ophthalmologist, or we need an obstetrician, or we need a family doctor. At this stage of your career, there's a baby being born, or there's a traumatic injury in the cockpit, or there's a heart attack occurring. At this stage, do you answer the call, or do you bow your head and just pray that everything turns out?
Well, I would certainly answer the call. I'm still somewhat involved in ophthalmology. I work occasionally down at the Seeger Medical Clinic, and I still enjoy doing that. And I'm also a commercial pilot, so maybe I'd be better in that part of the emergency. But definitely I would answer the call, and I would try to, you know, still do the best I can. I still feel a part of the medical community.
Yes, I would answer it. And depending on all the circumstances, it's probably a dumb thing to do sometimes, but I'm afraid I've done other dumb things before. I would answer it.
I would answer that call, and that circumstance has occurred and did one time. And it was a person with angina, and all we had was aspirin, and aspirin worked.
Thank you. Before I allow this last question, I would answer the call, but I would have a question first of the pilot or of this, the attendants. As a pathologist, is the patient dead yet? All right, last question.
Just a comment. $1,000 in 1958 had the buying power of $8,700 now, so still a lot cheaper than $8,700 a year is a lot cheaper than current medical schools.
Thank you all. This was most enjoyable, entertaining, and I think it is just great for the collegiality that we experience at this meeting to be able to reflect back on things and gain from the experience of others who have been here longer than we, because at some point we will be there also. Thanks for coming. Our next session will start within just about 2 minutes.
We should do this again.
There's some others who want to do it.
Well.